Hello and welcome to Unfrozen, episode number 84. I'm your co-host Greg Lindsay, and today's episode is themed to movement. Movements, perhaps, as well. Dan, who is our guest today?
Our guest is Marco Tebremostrut, who is the chair of the Urban Mobility Futures at the Amsterdam Institute for Social Science Research at the University of Amsterdam. His teaching centers on the relationship between land use developments and mobility behavior. As the founding academic director of the Urban Cycling Institute, he strengthens the links between academia and how cycling relates to the urban and social environment. Many call him the cycling professor. Marco, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
The impetus for his appearance on the show is that he has co-authored a book with the journalist Talia Verkad called Movement, which is about how to take back our streets and transform our lives, with the obvious emphasis here on cycling. And I think it might be, to start off, a little bit received wisdom that there should be a Dutch professor who is writing about cycling.
I was going to say, it took us until our 84th episode that we finally gave into the urbanist podcast cliche to have a Dutchman come on to talk about cycling, how cycling fixes cities. So Marco, thank you for helping us achieve that milestone.
Well, it's an honor, but also big pressure on my shoulders. But I will try to maybe dispel some of the myths that exist around this so-called perfect world, and I think the book is a helpful guide in that. So let's see if we can help some of the listeners to shed some of their deeply held beliefs about this country.
Exactly. That's exactly how I would like to start. Most people think of the Netherlands as a cycling utopia, and that people have cycled there since bicycles were invented and were always adamant about doing so. But that's not the case, is it?
No, there you have one big myth already, is that indeed there's something in our water or in our DNA that makes us bike, or that we are born on a bike. That's definitely not the case. And the book, of course, first was published in Dutch, and it was already an eye-opener for Dutch people to realize that the thing they take so much for granted, the fact that there's ubiquitous bike infrastructure everywhere, is actually something that started to appear only after the 1970s. So before that, the Dutch cities were actually hiring mostly American engineers to come to Amsterdam, for instance, also the city of Utrecht, to develop these plans to modernize our cities to become more like American cities. It was not a fringe group. It was really taking over the hearts and minds of the policymakers to change our cities away from these messy places into more modern car-dominated cities. And at the time, you can look back in the pictures, you see that in the 60s and 70s, Dutch cities, also the city of Amsterdam and Utrecht, were filled with cars. Right? Everywhere there were cars. So it's almost the first shockwave that our book brought about in the Netherlands itself was the realization that, oh, wait a minute, everything that's around here and that we like so much is actually fought for and relatively new, and we need to keep fighting for it.
There are a lot of terms of trade that have come out of the Dutch revolution in cycling, some of which apply more broadly to urban design. I have a couple of words here that I want to make sure that we talk about because they are talked about a lot in the book. Only one of them is, I believe, actually Dutch. Vonerf. I had seen that term before, but there are other terminologies in here that were unfamiliar to me, including chicane, chip cone, and cauliflower neighborhoods. Perhaps you could take us through some of these terms of use and how they relate.
Yeah, so maybe it's good to start with people who haven't read the book. The book is of course about mobility in the street and cycling and so forth, but it's actually a book about language and how language has shaped the world around us. And you name quite some interesting examples. So to start off with the Vonerf, actually we found that although it is famous around the world to basically design streets for children and local communities, it's an idea that comes from the Dutch textbook traffic engineering, but has been abandoned in the Netherlands since, I think, 15 years or so. In the new sustainable safe principles, you wouldn't find that category any longer. So it, again, it's, also blew away my mind, because I've grown up on such a Woon Erf, which was very pleasant. So we basically throughout the book, we tried to follow the thread of how language has shaped our thinking. And to a large extent, the language of traffic engineering, I would say, shaped our thinking in many problematic ways of thinking about how the city should work. But the cauliflower example is also a powerful example of how new language can reshape our thinking. Because basically it refers to the urban design of neighborhoods around the Woon Erf. And if you have to explain it to people, it's literally, if you look from it from above, it is shaped like a cauliflower or a tree or a brain, which has one entrance, and then you don't have any through traffic. So it looks a bit like all kinds of small spirals ending up nowhere, which allowed all these dead-end streets to become Woon Erf streets. So that's a very Dutch word, bloemkoolwijken, which actually stands for a very typical type of 80s, 90s development. But we found in the book, and also later in diving deeper, that the term actually comes from a German architect and urban designer who came up with it, never used it. There's no cauliflower neighborhood as far as we know in Germany. The Netherlands is ripe with it. And it shows us again that if you develop new metaphors, new ways of thinking, you actually can reshape the world accordingly.
I think that there's kind of two levels of the use of language here that are interesting in terms of how we think about the layout of our cities. One is, you know, sort of what we just discussed, where you know, we're talking about labeling certain types of road design or street design. You know, ways that they narrow to encourage slower vehicular movement, the way that they kind of keep the pavement and the road at the same level, so that drivers, you know, will inherently understand that, you know, there's a greater danger to pedestrians if they are not separated from the pedestrians. That's kind of the general concept.
It's a beautiful Dutch word. It's uitritconstructie. It's a typical engineering term that nobody knows, but it's so important element of this pleasant experience of the city in most cities. And it's indeed making it, simply designing it so that every car driver who enters the road has to cross the sidewalk, while in most other contexts, the pedestrian has to cross the road. And it's these simple things that we are not even aware of as Dutch people that are, I would say, in terms of language, they construct the world around us, and we no longer think it's weird. So it's almost a given. But also they are often grounded in language itself. So the people that have designed it, of course, were already thinking differently about streets than your regular traffic engineer. And that's also, you referred earlier to the chip cone, which again is a bit weird translation from patatzak in Dutch, which was an epiphany basically by local traffic engineers who decided in Amsterdam, hey, let's stop designing cities, intersections based on rigid guidelines, as we would normally. Yeah, that's one of the things we actually learned from U.S. traffic engineers, that you need these guidelines so that everywhere is the same and you have a certain level of coherence in the system. But these Amsterdam engineers thought, well, instead of designing the from guidelines an intersection and then forcing everybody's behavior into the guideline, what if we turn it around and look first at what the most frequent user of intersection in Amsterdam, often the cyclist, does? And can we not use that as input to redesign it? And then they came up with the chip cone, which basically is simply putting the middle line of a bike path, not straight, but slightly to the side. How would you translate that as sort of a backlash? which allowed cyclists to do what they're good at, swarming behavior. And then we had to find a name for it, right? So the name comes after the fact, and it's sort of a way of challenging the language that we used before.
So it kind of looks like, to describe it, it's called a chip cone, I believe, because basically it looks like the tips of two soft serve ice cream cones facing each other, slightly offset. So they're a little bit asymmetrical, but basically it's a narrowing effect to get across the intersection in a more naturalistic way, the way that cyclists normally behave, as opposed to three lanes or five lanes of cyclists all going at once the way cars do, because we can't expect people to maneuver their cars into those tiny bottlenecks or we'll have horrible traffic implications. But cyclists can do it very well. So it's just a way of not applying the thinking of automobile engineering to cycle paths.
Yeah, and actually it's indeed funny to realize that the people using the intersection afterwards or before, as we filmed them, they do exactly the same thing. But now they feel much more comfortable because the infrastructure, like the simple fact of changing that painted line, makes them much more comfortable because it's actually the infrastructure supports their natural behavior that you already do. But before it was illegal because you're basically what cyclists do is they sense that there are so many people waiting for the light to go green to cross that if they don't spread out, they create a problem in the back. So people start to crowd out and because they already know that as the light goes green, I'm the faster one, so I'm on the left, so I will actually be able to go to the other side. So it's not that the design changed the actual behavior, but the behavior became much more accommodated by the design. And it sounds like a very benign technical thing, but it actually shows the deeper layer of every line on the street is a political choice. And that's something you easily forget because you think, oh, this comes from the guideline of a technocratic process where a traffic engineer who studied this came up with this is the best solution. And actually by challenging that, that was what I wanted to show Talia, who was just a journalist coming into this field and sort of tumbled into one rabbit hole after the other. Like, oh, so pushing a button to cross the street is actually a political statement almost of who is important, who needs to beg and who doesn't. And this line on the chip cone for me really represented that ongoing battle, you could say. And if you can unlock in that battle the awareness that even a painted line can be repainted, I think it's almost a superpower.
Before I let Greg take over with some questions, I have one. I want to build one more point on this idea of language because I think it's quite revelatory. The way we talk about traffic accidents and collisions, you highlight this in your book, where a person was hit by a car, a child wandered into the street and was hit. You know, they're all described in passive voice as if vehicles are not operated by people and they are a natural force. It would be like a child wandered into a rushing river. You know, but it's in fact, there was a choice involved. There was a decision made. There was someone else operating the car. Why don't we say a driver killed a pedestrian who wandered into the street? It's really interesting to look at it that way because it places the blame for accidents on people who are not automobile drivers. I thought that was a really interesting revelation in the book. Did you do any sort of, I don't want to say longitudinal survey, but did you do any sort of wide scoping survey for how these accidents are represented in language and across different languages, different countries, you know, in different jurisdictions? Is it consistent or is it something that we see only in the Netherlands or in Western countries? I'd be curious to see if this is like a consistent way of talking about the prioritization of the automobile over the pedestrian or cyclist.
Yeah, it's actually who brought this to my attention is an American researcher, professor in, I think, sociology, Peter Norton, who wrote the awesome book on fighting traffic, and basically showed us how this entire language and everything we use here has been invented in the 1930s. So in the 1920s, when cars became started to flood U.S. cities mostly, there was no traffic engineering. It didn't exist. It just it happened. And what happened actually was that a lot of children especially were killed by car drivers. And you wouldn't find a single newspaper article at that time giving blame to the child. It was completely clear that it was fully unjustified to blame a child for this, and that this innovation was just not acceptable to take over the street. And of course, we know that this is not the end of the story, right? Something happened. And Peter Norton shows how in 10 years' time, basically the language of traffic engineering was invented by water engineers. And they started to think about this as pipeline systems that should never be clogged, but should always be free-flowing. And all these the very direct metaphors taken from that and from biology, thinking about the heart of the city and arteries and bypasses, and also arteries should never be clogged. And this logic sort of shaped into a language that we then started to speak. And only 10 years later, you could indeed blame the child for not sticking to the rules of that new game. And it was considered relatively normal to do that. So now, actually, the last couple of years, there's a lot of research into this in the US mostly. But we set up and already also mentioned in the book, we set up a citizen-led research platform. It's called roaddanger.org, where people can upload, because mostly these crashes, as I think we should call them, happen they happen everywhere. They're ubiquitous. It's crazy if you think about the numbers of people being killed today in traffic, right? Everywhere. However, their crashes are often only reported in local news media, which means that most people do not get this overview. They only get this local newspaper articles. So we ask them, okay, upload your local newspaper articles and rubricize them. So help us understand who was involved, but also how does the heading, for instance, mention the different parties. And that allows us to do exactly this research. And indeed, what we find, and that's quite horrific, I would say, is that this way of thinking about it is everywhere. It's sort of so dominant. It's a monopoly that is linked to this idea that the mobility system, since we have invented traffic engineering, is seen as a machine where not justice is the most important thing or human suffering, but efficiency. It needs to function efficiently to shuttle people as quickly and comfortable as possible from A to B. And that became an unquestioned sort of holy grail. If you look into political programs in any country or city in the Netherlands, from the left to the right, that is an unquestioned, assumed goal of the system. But we can discuss if it needs to be e-cars or regular cars or maybe buses or trains. But we seldomly question the notion that this system should shuttle people as quickly as possible from A to B with all its consequences. And therefore, talking about crashes as glitches in the machine is sort of almost assumed worldview that you cannot blame anybody for. This is just how we talk about it, right? Every half an hour on every radio station across the world, every half an hour, we talk about congestion on this system. Like the system is something is wrong. But we never talk about the human tragedy that's happening every day. What if we would do that every half an hour on every radio station? Or let's say, because if you count it up, it's 360 minutes a week per radio station, 6 hours of radio time every week is spent on congestion. So what if we would stop doing that and every Friday spend two of these hours on beautiful music, and the 4 hours that are left, we can talk about the human tragedy of that week, like people who died, people who never got home, people who lost their kids. I think if we would do that, then it would take us maybe 2 months, and then there will be an outrage, because people will not accept it. But by talking about it as if it is glitches in the machine, people can keep it at a distance. So the urgency of solving that problem becomes much much less.
Yes, I'm very fond of quoting Stafford Beer's maxim that the purpose of a system is what it does, that there is no such thing as a malfunctioning system. It is producing its intended output by perhaps the hidden political interest behind it. And I might want to come back to that one in light of Governor Hochul's in New York State decision, single-handed decision to indefinitely postpone congestion pricing and the policy levers there. But first, I want to ask a question that challenges your national pride, which is Amsterdam and the Netherlands still the leader in thinking about the implications of an urban policy built around cycling? Because two examples that immediately come to mind, particularly for an American who can look at it from afar and see idealism, the Barcelona Superblock, which unveiled during the pandemic, and the cultural practice around the bike bus, which I find utterly adorable. And then also obviously pegged to next month's Summer Olympics in Paris, Mayor Anne Hidalgo and her crusade to overhaul this, with Carlos Moreno of the Sorbonne whispering in her ear about the 15-minute city. I'm curious from your perspective, your thoughts on how are they advancing policy? How have they gotten political buy-in to do this, and what lessons come from that? And yeah, what in your opinion is really like the bleeding edge here of sort of bike-based urban policy?
Well, you captured it all in that question. So let me try to unpack my thoughts on that. Is okay. So going back to the 1970s, right? Dutch cities, like cities everywhere, were infested by car traffic. It conquered the hearts and minds, and we were planning for it. And then there was this huge resistance from the population, for many reasons we won't go into here. But there was resistance, and within that resistance against brutal capitalism, against the modern city, the modern society around efficiency, the 1968 Paris, and it was also in Amsterdam. And a very strong symbol here became the bicycle. John Lennon, Yoko Ono were in bed in the Hilton in 1969 with a blue, white-painted bicycle. So I often ask people, like, why were they in bed with a bicycle? And then we explore what happened afterwards. So the point of that whole story is they were in bed with a bicycle because it represented a radically new language. The bicycle was not interesting because it would solve congestion. It was in bed because it represented human society around love, not efficient, but meaningful, being underway, not as a disutility, but as where life happens. All the artists that were around that, it was a really, really strong symbolic moment. Okay, what happened then, I would say, also a very short interpretation, but is instead of, because we were winning, and so that side of things were winning at that time. And then they signed the truce. So 1975, I think, is the moment where they signed the truce and said, okay, instead of winning this, we want a seat at the table. So many of the people from that movement actually became politicians, and we launched something that we now know as the Cyclist Union. And the Cyclist Union in this truce made it possible for us, and that is why I think you should also come to the Netherlands and learn from us. What can you achieve within still having the car-based traffic engineering system for cycling? You can achieve a lot, but I can also tell you that the max of that is about 27% of cycling trips. We have achieved that. We're also very car dependent. We have a very high car ownership, so we can show you a system where it can coexist. It's a very expensive system, but you can learn from us how to do that. Okay, but that limits us currently in the new radical steps that are required. If I would propose a super block in Amsterdam, having a playground in the middle of an intersection to calm down traffic, my biggest opponent would be the Cyclist Union. Because the bicycle became part of the same logic of bringing people quickly from A to B, right? We are building bicycle highways, and we are making the bicycle also efficient and fast, which never was the dream of John Lennon. And that brings me back to my interpretation of what's happening. And I don't know exactly what's happening, but it's fascinating material. Or maybe I do know, or at least that's my hypothesis. And you already pointed out Carlos Moreno whispering in the ear of Anne Hidalgo, who decided to run in the re-election on this crazy idea of telling people, if you vote for me, I will fix this city. I will make it a 15-minute city, but basically with four principles around it. I will make sure that you can have a good life without being dependent on fast mobility. And this means planting 170,000 trees. This means constructing 300 school streets where cars are no longer allowed. This means creating also all kinds of proximities, developing smaller shops and so on. And to me, it shows the power of unleashing a new narrative, because, as we see everywhere, people are saying this is madness. She is political. She's pulling a political suicide, and instead she was voted in. And you see this thing everywhere, that we really think, oh no, you cannot stand up against this modern idea of that the city needs to be efficient and car based and oriented towards economic growth. And every time a politician does it, Pontevedra is an example, Barcelona is an example, Milan is working on it, Paris, the city of Brussels, you see that actually the popular votes go up. So we are afraid of what in the book Talia calls a carnival mirror. We think that we are facing huge resistance, but that's just because we haven't figured out how to tell a new story. Because that new story, in the old story, and we are in the Netherlands really good at talking that old story. I'm involved in several referenda on, and the referendum is, okay, we have a problem with space. And actually the biggest problem is it's full of private cars. And we need to get rid of it because we have all these other goals. Well, everybody agrees on that. Yeah, everybody agrees. So what do we ask people in a referendum? Do you want paid parking or free parking? So what do you think Dutch people would say, right? So in this old story, you actually activate people that have something to lose in this. They will defend the status quo. But you also see in these elections that a large majority of people do not even show up because you didn't trigger them. You didn't activate them. And I think I try to help the Dutch politicians and Dutch policymakers to look at Paris and Barcelona to show the power of ask questions in a different language. Because only then you will see, for instance, yes, people love their cars, but also people love their children and people love dogs. And if you cannot walk your dog because of all the cars, you have a very different vote in a referendum. So I hope that sort of, that these are my thoughts, that actually for me, Barcelona and Paris really show the power of language. And what the Netherlands shows is if you do not challenge the narrative, it's actually a quote by Piersig, Zen in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. He says, if you destroy a factory, but you do not destroy its foundation, a new factory will emerge over and over again. So if you do not change the narrative, as I think we largely did in the Netherlands, you are just building the same factory, but now with fast bikes instead of cars. But you haven't really solved the systemic problems that are underneath.
Well, building off that then, what is the systemic political consensus and coalition that made that possible? So to tie it back to current events in the United States, what's happening in New York, where congestion pricing has been paused, it's interesting because there you have a combination of transit and cycling advocacy groups, Riders Alliance and others, combined with environmental groups, combined with the pro-business lobbies of New York, and they're being opposed by teachers' unions and police unions have come out against it, and suburbanites on Long Island, because then it gets factored back into U.S. national politics about control of the House of Representatives. So it's very interesting because it's a completely, you know, some would say cross-cutting, others would say dysfunctional array of political groups against each other. What were the core consensus groups in the Netherlands to do that? I do find it funny that the bike lobby lived long enough to become the villain. That is a twist I did not know there. But
yeah, it's not a villain. Again, it's very important always to say, keep learning from the Dutch, keep watching Not Just Bikes, keep learning, but also be aware that that all those advances came with a price. And the price is that we lost activism. We suited ourselves in thinking that we solved it, but instead we even cemented further the traffic engineering mindset of dividing space and conquer. One final example of that is the city of Groningen, famous for their first traffic circulation plan, banning cars, 1980, actually. Both councillors that were for this received death threats, similar as now, did it anyway, and became the most popular people ever. Right? No, nobody wants to return, but they say 40 years later, yes, we have a lot of bikes now, great. But still, if we are going to redesign any street in the city, we cannot plant a tree, we cannot have a play space for children, because the traffic engineer defines what happens between the walls of the houses. So now we are working with them to rethink, okay, but maybe you then now need to make the next step and really questioning the underlying simplification of the street as a traffic engineering point of view. So if you go back again to the 70s and this potential, it's indeed fascinating to see that what happened there was a coalition also of what was called the provosts, so really the anti-socialites, you could say. I think it wasn't so much environmental, but it was also affordable housing crisis. People wanted the city to be affordable. It was actually the big riots that happened then were mostly those groups, squatters, but also it was against the building of a metro, funnily enough. Because the metro, of course, Amsterdam is a swamp. And to build a metro, you have to first demolish all the houses. And the idea was, oh, let's then rebuild back this American-style modern city. So the riots were against that. But also they were joined by the elite who were protecting monuments. So it was a really crazy. But what I find most interesting there also is that the bicycle there was like the 15-minute city is now. It was sort of a very strong, it was only a symbolic marker that allowed everybody to express something like this. The bike in John Lennon's bed was not a beautiful specialized, right? It was an old rickety, single speed, sitting upright, white painted Dutch men's bicycle. Also, all that represented something. And that's something that I think is also, I'm also looking at from a distance to New York, but already calling something congestion pricing is not a very smart move. It is about so much more than that. And I think actually I see what I see happening everywhere is that either you go for the narrative and you push it and you get the popular support, or and that's also an approach. And I think New York is sort of following that since Janet Sadik Khan, is you go step by step and you say, okay, let's try it. Let's do something. And maybe congestion pricing is not the easiest, although Stockholm actually tried it. But we can try changing Times Square and that sort of rippled off. Actually, what my understanding is that the city of New York is planning to put all their motorized vehicles of their fleet, which is somewhere between 10,000 and 20,000 cars that they own, like the garbage trucks and all these things. They want to put them on what is called intelligent speed assistance, which will geofence basically their speed, like we do with kick scooters. If they do that, which they can, they don't need any popular vote on that. This will calm down the entire road system of New York City, because if you have 30% of car traffic speed regulated, on most streets you can't overtake. So it will actually calm down the entire systems. And I think there's this continuous, you have to think about where can we place the next bucket of flowers. And sometimes opportunities arise. Where can we have the New York version of Sam Belto doing the first bicycle bus? And then be ready for linking it up to this bigger narrative. And that's what we try to show in the book, is that these things not only matter. Well, first of all, it feels a bit nihilistic or overwhelming, like, oh, this story and this big story and how I can never change it. Yes, you can. That's one of the most powerful things that we as humans can do is continuous reinventing language and narratives. So we have to do these two things together, because most of the resistance is also, it is, I would say, it's a fear of change, and we need courage and curiosity to move forward, because by resisting congestion pricing or paid parking, you're not solving the problem, right? So and the problems are increasingly showing up. Like, we are running into the physical limits of this system. It's no longer an ideological battle. It's sort of accepting the fact that the current system, as it currently is, cannot sustain in the next 100 years. Just cannot. The amount of asphalt and concrete that is required. So I know, for instance, in Canada, I don't know the numbers in the US, but they will probably be quite similar, that Canada is having a $46 billion backlash in maintenance of the highways. That means that literally, technically, most of the highways are not up to the safety standards, and we also cannot afford to make that happen. If you all these numbers, if you add them up, there's no, the question is not, should we do congestion pricing or not? The question really is, we need to solve this, otherwise it will collapse. Let's try things, man.
In terms of things that are being tried or have been tried, we've mostly talked about psychological and physical road engineering. There's a lot of technocratic and technical solutions being discussed as well. Do you feel apprehensive or excited about people talking about various types of apps? You mentioned the geofencing that is done on, or could potentially be done on, New York City municipal vehicles. Is there a technology that you think is underutilized or that we should be using more that would help deal with some of these hard physical limitations of how much landscape there is to pave over and how many vehicles can fit into a space?
Well, I think we should, in these times of urgency, we should go for the technologies that all have already proven themselves, which I would say, learning from the Dutch context here, is the train and the bike. And if you combine them, you get this crazy synergies that basically outcompete the car on most trips that people take, but require also an urban adaption over time. But I would say that I could say that most of the technological innovations that pop up in people's minds, if you talk about technological innovations, self-driving vehicles, the Hyperloop, and what have you, are mostly just the logical next step in the same line of thinking that brought us into the problems. They still sell sort of seamless or fast and easy. It sells us a utopian idea of teleportation, right? It makes us believe that what we are looking at, so basically in most countries, the main the main request for investment in technology, but also in road infrastructure or other infrastructure, is based on travel time savings, with the false, provenly false assumption that people save travel time if you allow them to go faster from A to B. But underlying is this idea that, okay, apparently we still have this dream that mobility is a disutility and we actually shouldn't want it. We should. So I show people this image of Mercedes-Benz, where you have the self-driving vehicle with four people inside with VR glasses on, right? It's, if this is our dream, what are we doing? Like, yes, no disutility anymore. Yes, no travel time anymore. You can do all these other things. Like what? Like sitting and watching commercials? So going back again to John Lennon, Yoko Ono and their bike, is it is also coming to terms that the underlying logic that this system needs to serve to get us as fast as possible to A to B is the problem in itself. And it's a relatively young story. It wasn't there before the 1930s. And I think and then we can talk about which technology fits there or not, but I think we first need to acknowledge that technology is not neutral, and it can either propel us forward in that same erratic utopian line of thinking, which again is proven wrong, right? We empirically know that this will not materialize. People do not win travel time. They lose travel distance. We know this already for 50 years. So it's wrong and it's problematic. And if we do not develop reflexivity to talk about all these new technologies, because there will be new ones in 5 years, but if we don't discuss them in terms of, okay, but what political direction do they take us? I think it's a problem. Then it's a very problematic debate to have. Like what? And again, also the example of congestion pricing. That's the tool. That's the technology. But that is not the question you should ask the citizens of New York. You should ask them, what kind of city do you want? And then we also don't ask them, what should we do with this pipeline? We just fix it. So here also we need to have a conversation about, because underneath this congestion pricing and all these things, and underneath how Times Square is redeveloped and other places, is our political choices. And I think that's where Talia and I ended up. First realizing, whoa, wait a minute, the street is designed? Who is working on this? Oh, there's actually this whole field. And then going deeper and deeper, realizing that, wait a minute. And that's also what are the best reviews of the book so far are people that read it that were not thinking about mobility before, suddenly realize and go on a trajectory with Talia, realize that there is all these layers, and then realize that it's actually something to care about. It's very important how the street is designed. And if it, for instance, caters for the autonomy of your children, and if it doesn't, you should go and fight for it, because it's not a given. It looks a given. It looks a very fixed thing, but and New York shows this, you can change it overnight.
So Marco, one of my favorite takeaways from this conversation is the cognizance that Montreal and Amsterdam are of course forever linked as the two sites of the John and Yoko bed-ins. The other one was here at the Fairmont Elizabeth. And also it's very germane to this because our mayor, Valerie Plante, is also famous as one of the great bicycle mayors and investing in the infrastructure. But one of the smartest things that I feel that she has done and the government has done here is that they resisted all efforts by the shared mobility companies, Lime, Bird, all others, to impinge upon that and maintain control over the shared Bixi fleet, which is increasingly electric. It's one of my favorite things of living here, particularly this time of year. My question for you is, Marco, given we've seen sort of the boom and total bust of a lot of the shared mobility companies that were really sort of bidding to, you know, try to have some sort of blitz scaling effect similar to what Uber did, what's your prescription for policies for governments and what they should do for ownership of vehicles? I mean, is it simply a question of we should give subsidies for people to buy electric bikes and there should be private ownership of this? Is there a future in shared ownership and civic fleets of this? Where do you think that's going? Because, I mean, one of the examples from the pandemic was, you know, huge boom in private ownership of electric personal mobility devices in Europe, which I don't think has been quite the case in North America. But where do you fall on that sort of policy prescription in terms of how we should subsidize or deploy it?
Yeah, that's also a great question. And the question, again, goes back to what are they actually selling us? Like, most of these services are selling us even more seamless mobility. That would for me is always a red flag. I learned from the provost in the 70s. Life is not about seamless. A seamless life is a waste. We should embrace friction. So that's one thing. The other thing is we know that most, if not all, mobility innovations are not making a profit, right? So all these boom and bust, they happen all the time. Even Uber is not making a profit. It's growing and it's bigger and it's impacting all of us, but it's not making a profit. And why is that? I think that brings us also to one of the key points that we need to discuss here, is because they compete mainly, at least that they try to compete mainly with getting people out of cars, right? That's the logic. Like, invest in us, we will get people out of cars. But there are two problems with that. One is that you are competing with a highly subsidized opponent. Like a car, owning and using a car is incredibly subsidized by society, which means that if you compete against that in the market with a market price, you can never win. This is the most rigged competition, and every American politician should be against this market distortion, right? Because this market distortion stops all of them from being. It's like 40 to 60% of owning and driving is subsidized by society at large. That should stop, not only by putting the cost where they belong, that's one thing, but also by lowering the cost, because we shouldn't put a price on a human's life. And that's one reason why I think the only technology that I so far can really support is intelligent speed assistance, where we say it's no longer acceptable that you drive around killing children. And therefore, that cost will be taken out, which means that your car will be slower, which makes other alternatives more interesting. So actually, everybody that's in the field of mobility innovations should spend 1 year, stop everything they do, and focus on how can we make the cost of driving more fair, because after that, all their mobility innovations become more interesting. Without that, I think it's a lost battle. The second thing, and I think it relates to that, is what happens if you cannot compete with a car is that most of these mobility innovations actually compete with walking and cycling. And then we should be really careful, because very quickly you then run into perverse effects, because especially cycling as we have seen from Ivan Illich and all other thinkers, somehow hits a very, very sweet spot in terms of what it allows us to do and against the cost for society. So every alternative to that, we should be very wary of. One of the things that I'm very wary of and try to study is indeed ownership, and ownership to a very deep level. So we in the Netherlands have this innovation, which is called the swap bike, where a company now commodifies bike repair. So you have a monthly subscription, you have a bike. As soon as you have a flat tire, you go on the app and they swap your bike. It's successful. It doesn't make a profit, but it's successful. It's growing loads of bikes on the street. Yay, more bikes. And I was wondering, but wait a minute, isn't the act of repair of your bicycle, isn't the bicycle so empowering because you can actually repair it yourself, right? These people that go on the Great Divide, right? They go unsupported because you can actually fix the bike yourself. You need some tools, but you can do that. So what we try to figure out is this idea of the bicycle as a convivial tool, just like your hammer. Like, most people do not like to give their hammer to somebody else, which a hammer is a hammer, but somehow you recognize that this hammer improves my human ability without losing something. So there are many of those tools, and I think the bicycle also fits there, is that actually the act of owning a bike is so important on how it makes you relate to the world, that we should be very careful in replacing that with shared services, especially because they are lacking a good business case. As I explained earlier, they are also looking for all kinds of other ways, for instance, using your data and having all kinds of other perverse ways of commodifying you and making you, again, more dependent, basically, on the functioning of this company. Well, I think the bicycle, and I was born 7 days after John Lennon was shot. I'm not saying that I'm a reincarnation, but I'm trying to sort of channel that energy. And I think that they were not in bed with a bicycle. And that's also, by the way, a very funny fact. The bicycle was the white painted bicycle, and it's seen as sort of the father of all the bike sharing systems afterwards, because the white painted bicycle of the provost was actually the first generation of shared bicycles. But it never was intended to be a commercial product. The idea was nobody locks their bikes anymore, and there's no possession anymore. So everybody can freely use each other's resources, which is quite opposite, I would say, to all the services that are trying to sell this idea of shared bikes, which are basically rental bikes of a company. So that's, but all these things I think are important to develop as society more reflexivity upon, and that's again what we try to do also with the book, we need to think better because there's so much on the line, and we are currently doing ourselves a disservice both in not getting the traction and the support for the changes that are required, but also it's actually a very American example, but it's this idea of a dog that's sort of trying to that you try to walk somewhere and then sees a squirrel. And every time a new mobility innovation is like, ooh, squirrel, squirrel. And we talk about the mobility innovation while we actually should talk about the elephant in the room, right? How are we quickly going to downscale the fleet of cars that we are subsidizing as society?
All right. Instructions for life and how to build a successful future city. Keep your eyes on the elephants and try not to get distracted by the squirrels.
Yeah. And use your superpower of language, because we all have that. And you will find that if you want to change things, you will find many more people like you if you manage to bring it in a positive narrative.
Marco, thank you so much for joining us today on Unfrozen, author of Movement, How to Take Back Our Streets and Transform Our Lives. This has been fascinating. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.